Welcome to Coffee and Contemplation, a Stranger Things podcast. I'm Robin.
I'm Heidi.
And today we begin season four with chapter one, The Hellfire Club. First of all, I want to give a shout out to new listeners. We actually, as of this recording, we just got a ton of new listeners, like just had this huge increase. So hello to all of you and so happy to have all of you on board. And then happy to have any returning listeners, of course, as always. Thanks for sticking with us through our little hiatus that we took there. We are very happy to be back. But as any returning listeners will know, it has been a minute for Coffee and Contemplation. We are a year out from the release of season four's first volume. There are a few reasons for this little break that we've taken. Season four was a lot. The episodes were longer, the content was denser, there's just a lot happening. And as a result of that, I knew that I needed to sit with season four, just to kind of make heads or tails of it in my own mind, let alone jump on the mic and attempt coherent analysis. And then on top of that, our whole deal in this pod is taking close readings and applying critique and in an application type style. And as I mentioned, I believe in our season four Hopes, Fears, Expectations episode, we had the first three seasons in our lives, in our pop cultural consciousness for many years. I mean, even season three. And that naturally played a part in how we approached our episode discussions. So taking this time away has been part of building up my familiarity with this installment of the show and allowing it to sort of steep before approaching the episodes. The second reason for this hiatus is that I launched a second podcast. It's called Classified, and it's our tagline for it is applying D&D to every fandom, one character at a time. And so in each episode, myself and two other co-hosts attempt to build playable D&D characters inspired by three to four characters from our favorite fandoms. And so far we have three episodes out, one on some ladies from Arcane, the Super Mario Brothers, and Into the Spider-Verse. So launching that took a lot of bandwidth, but as a result of working on that podcast, it really did take me out of the Stranger Things fandom, and in the last few weeks, I've realized just how much I've missed it. So I'm really happy to be back. And then lastly, before we commence with the breakdown for this episode, it's the beginning of a new season. Just want to briefly touch on what you can expect with the podcast moving forward and kind of just like where we kind of fall with this season and with the show at large, like we've done for every other season before. So with all the time that's passed since the first volume was released, Heidi, how do you feel about the show now versus when we first watched it?
I think some of my initial reactions, like the immediate intensity of my immediate reactions, have faded. I mean, it's been a year. I still stand by my reading of the material. The things that I complained about when we talked about it last year still bother me, but the intensity has faded. And I think I've had a similar journey with season four as I did with season three. You know, when I first watched it, I had a big negative reaction because there were a lot of things that were going on in season three that just weren't for me. And I think I feel similarly about season four. I think the show has just, as a whole, moved in a direction that is maybe not for me. But that doesn't mean that I hate it and all of the things that I liked about season four when I watched it the first time, because there were a number of things that I liked quite a bit. I still like them. We watched episode one on Tuesday just to prep for this recording, and I found myself enjoying the things that I liked more, and mainly because I knew they were coming. The things that upset me, again, I still didn't enjoy them, but they bothered me less. So when we did our reaction episode to 8 and 9, I think I remember distinctly saying, I'm not coming back for episode by episode. I was just too upset by what happened to Eddie and what happened to Max. So I just didn't think I would be able to be objective about it. Now I feel more able to be objective about it, which is normal. It's been a year.
Mm-hmm. One of the most complicated and intimidating parts of approaching season four was the fact that I, in spite of the fact that I had a big emotional reaction to the ending, I didn't have a clear response to it overall. And that was new for me. You know, with each season, I knew where I stood pretty quickly and pretty definitively. Season one is brilliant. The best season, in my opinion, still head and shoulders above all the others, including season four. Season two is still my personal favorite. Season three, huge stylistic change, not really for me. You know, even if the nuance and the detail of how I saw the stories or, you know, my appreciation changed over time, you know, as is evident with the podcast episodes. But with season four, the short version is it's a mixed bag for me. There are aspects that I love, you know, absolute exquisite storytelling in places. There are aspects that are sort of middling and meh, and there are aspects that I outright hate and find actively harmful. And I struggle with all of those being equally true and being an equal part of my takeaway more than any of the other seasons that have come before this. And it's made me think of something that Jenna said back in one of our reaction episodes as well.
This whole season, season four was, to me, in one word, divisive. If you go online and read people's perspectives on literally any aspect of it, I mean, everything about the season is so divisive. And so that's kind of crazy to go online and read. Everybody's just way different opinions on all spectrums.
So I think she called it when she said that. And I think that that was true at the time. I think it's true now. It's continued to be true all the way up to the present. And so my goal moving forward with the podcast is basically to kind of sit in that mixed bag mindset, to look at this season from the perspective of it being a bit of both, a bit of everything, to see how it feels to sit with it all simultaneously without having to necessarily make an overarching judgment one way or the other, and to kind of see where that leads through the journey across these very long 9 episodes. And not to discount that I think this season is also very personal for a lot of people, myself included, I think for you as well. Mm-hmm. In some ways, again, more than what's come before.
In some ways, yeah.
Yeah. And I think that that is important to mention here at the beginning, because I think that's going to affect a lot of, you know, at least my analyses moving forward. And we'll see how, you know, you're here for this episode and there will be a myriad of other co-hosts joining me this season. So,
yeah,
you know, that's going to be a question that I'm going to ask every co-host as they join me, because I want to see kind of how this season has affected everybody.
Season four is the first season of Stranger Things that was released post 2020. And Stranger Things fans and not Stranger Things fans, we have all gone through an enormous collective trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the themes of season four of Stranger Things are trauma and how you respond to it, grief, depression, self-harm. These are things that have been like part of the public consciousness a lot more vividly, mm-hmm. in my opinion, than they had been previously. And so I think the reason it's been divisive and the reason that you and I both consider the season as a whole to be a mixed bag is because it touches on these themes, but the follow through is not there. In some ways, it's almost like counter thematic. So I think another adjective that I would apply to the season as a whole is that in some ways it's really great. It fulfills the expectations that I would have as a viewer of Stranger Things. And in other ways, it's extremely jarring.
Mm-hmm. But in the interest of moving forward, one last housekeeping thing before we get into it. So because of the nature of this season being as dense and as long as it is, and these episodes being longer runtime, we're going to try something a little bit new. Although it's not too new, we're actually going to be reverting back to the episode structure that we started the podcast with, which is going through the episode by character group, sort of in this case, almost by geographical location in some cases, rather than doing the actual like beat for beat structure that we have been doing for the past most of season one and then seasons two and three, in a way that will be a little bit more suited to the listener palette, as opposed to being longer than the actual episodes themselves. Although I can't promise anything. We'll see how it shapes up as we go.
Yeah.
But that's the goal. I reserve the right to change my mind as we go through the season, but we'll see. So just because this episode of the podcast does have all of this introductory stuff, this is going to be part one of two. So for this episode, we're going to talk about the cold open and the California crew. And then next time we're going to talk about Hawkins. This is a dense season and the beginning episode has a lot to get into. So that was a lot of table setting. But with all of that said, we're not doing coffee selections because we do not have time for that in this season. But with that said, let's proceed with contemplation. So our first group that we're gonna talk about is just the cold open, because that's a lot unto itself. So to sum up, it's the tease of the Hawkins Lab massacre, Brenner getting ready for the day, the date card, reveal of the Rainbow Room, Brenner working with 10, the ramp up to the massacre, Brenner finding 11 covered in blood. Now, I can't remember. We talked about this before we watched it. Did you actually watch the clip that they released on YouTube before?
No.
I didn't think so. I know that this doesn't bother all of the Stranger Things fans. Like, this is something that I've heard not a lot of people talk about, which surprises me because I think you and I were so deeply affected by it.
And this is something that I feel exactly the same about now as I did a year ago. I'm really conflicted about it. It's an incredibly well-made sequence. I know, like, you have things to say about, like, the calm before the storm and the eeriness of that.
Mm-hmm.
That is incredibly well done. The fact that you don't see everything happening, you only get flashes of it. You only get like reactions to it. It's very, when I say it's realistic, that's not a compliment.
Mm-hmm.
This episode aired only a couple days after the Uvalde shooting.
Days, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so I think they probably felt that the best approach was to say nothing about it,
mm-hmm.
which from a PR standpoint probably was the least controversial thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
I don't necessarily think it was the ethical thing to do. And this is immediately we get into putting a moral lens onto fiction, which I have a real problem with. And yet here I am doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you and I off the mic, have had many discussions about my frustrations with people projecting real world politics for whatever reason onto fictional characters. Now, I do this as much as the next person, but I do so usually privately, you know, either in private conversations with you, but I don't do it on social media. And I don't. One thing that I said in our reaction episodes was, the Duffer brothers are not responsible for my mental health. However, I do think that as an artist, as a person, you do have to look at the world around you and be aware of and be accountable for what you're referencing. And furthermore, when you have pieces of art like Mississippi Goddam by Nina Simone and Strange Fruit by Billie Holiday, they are sung, performed by members of the affected community, which is really, that's really important because, mm-hmm. you know, me as a white woman living in the 21st century, I am not suggesting that there is no longer violence against Black people. Of course not. But for me to like write a song about the violence that is inflicted on the Black community, and then to get up and sing it as if I have authority on this subject is not appropriate. And I feel like we're in a little bit of a similar space with Stranger Things, because I don't know. I do not know for a fact that nobody connected to the Duffer brothers or connected to the production team, et cetera, has, that no one in that sphere has experienced gun violence or specifically a school shooting situation. But I feel pretty confident that if someone had, they would have objected to this. This does not feel like a piece of art that comes from a lived experience.
No, it's presented very much in the style of horror. Yeah, their lived experience is always very evident. And this, yeah, I agree with you. This doesn't feel like it.
So it's very skillfully made. I just don't think it's very responsibly made.
My feeling on this sequence is that I think the problem is that it's not that it's scary. I know a lot of people have described it that way. It's not scary to me. It's upsetting because it touches a nerve.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that that's kind of what you're talking about is kind of why I think it has been a year. And I understand those guys are busy. They're working on season 5. I get it. But at the same time, it's kind of like, I mean, I don't have the number in front of me, but it's not like we haven't had any school shootings this year. You know, I said in our reaction episode that this sequence reminds me a lot of Gus Van Sant's film Elephant. I stand by that. I even looked, like, you know, pulled up some scenes from the film, including the trailer, to make sure that I, like, wasn't misremembering it. And are they, like, one-to-one the same? No. But I would be really surprised if the Duffer brothers have never seen that film. And the reason that I say that they feel so similar is because even though they're about, at least on a surface level, they're about widely different things, what both this opening sequence, because Elephant, I'm not reminded of Elephant when you see the actual massacre later. It's something about the way that this opening sequence is constructed. It is the calm before the storm, but it's, Elephant is structured in a way where you know very early on, I mean, it's in the trailer, this is going to be a film about a school shooting. And so...
And just for context, in case people are not familiar with Elephant is about the Columbine school shooting.
It's not a biopic.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that was his influence when he made it. And it was made right around that time. But in that case, in the case of the film, and in the case of this cold open, they are both about looking at the context of things that are happening leading up to this big, bloody, violent event. Elephant is not the first film to do this, but there's something about the way that they are both structured, the fact that they both deal with children,
mm-hmm.
It's a tonal similarity. But at the same time, you know, for me, I think part of my issue with the way that this is presented, both here, mostly here, but throughout the first half of the season, really every time we flash back to it, and then particularly in chapter 7 when we get the full reveal of everything. Because again, if they were not consciously, intentionally choosing to make this reference, then what it comes down to is that they're using this as an aesthetic.
Yeah, for the shock value.
It's too close to a real world issue. And so it begins to get messy for me in that way. And it just ultimately leaves me feeling icky.
Yeah.
You know, that's the short version. You know, it touches on something that is a tangible trauma for a lot of people. And it's not a good look.
Yeah.
Now I will say that I did talk to the co-hosts over at Ham Radio, and I'm actually going to play a segment of that conversation that I had with them, because Jasmine brought up something very interesting.
So I'm Canadian and my friends are Canadian. So school shootings are not a part of our culture here. So that didn't even occur to me until I saw other people mention it online. I was like, oh yeah, that must be traumatizing for you guys. Not that there's never a mass casualty, but they're pretty few and far between. You can't easily get access to a gun here. I mean, the guns you do get access to are people smuggle them in from the States. You can't just walk into a store around here and buy a gun. You can get a hunting rifle. I won't say no one's going around killing people with hunting rifles, but it's not on the mass scale that you guys have. So, like, me and my friends don't have that bad reaction to this cold open, but I do totally get what you guys are saying. And that, like, if that is your reality, I totally get where everyone's coming from. Yeah.
So I just thought that was fascinating and a really valuable perspective. And I would actually encourage any of our listeners who are not American, and you know, how did this scene affect you, and did any of this occur for you? I would be very interested in hearing, you know, your thoughts and having you join the conversation in that regard. But, you know, in addition to all of that, the other side of it is just, this is also in addition to their setting it up, that it looks like the misdirect of the idea that Eleven did it.
Which is, that is kind of outright offensive.
And it's a lot to open your season with. I remember like starting to write down that in a way, this is both the most intense and the most understated opening of any of the Stranger Things seasons. Because season one, you open with the lab tech running through the halls, the Demogorgon gets him, then you kind of go back down, you get the D&D game, and then Will gets taken. Mm-hmm. That's a lot, but it's kind of a peak and a valley and another peak. And then season two, you've got the opening with Kali, which is much shorter, but it's a lot, but it's nowhere near this. And then season three is the Russians,
yeah,
which is a totally different tone than this. So yeah, it's just strange. This is like runs the gamut of all the tone and pacing and intensity all at once.
Yeah.
And I remember on that first watch, I was big mad about it. I was very unhappy and I was not sure how the rest of the episode was going to proceed because it was not a comfortable place to be.
Yeah. I distinctly remember I came very, very near to saying, I tap out from this scene, you know, mm-hmm. maybe not even from the whole episode, but I was like, I cannot watch this. When we watched the episode 2 days ago, we skipped the massacre itself, or I skipped the massacre itself, watched all the context and then, you know, of course, the rest of the episode, but did not watch the actual scenes themselves.
I did when I watched it independently to make my notes,
mm-hmm.
But I will not. I probably will never watch it again.
Yeah.
Just in that regard, I have to say that given all of that, the episode eventually won me back over, and relatively quickly. The next group we're going to talk about is the California crew. So Elle's struggles with school and being bullied, and she's lying to Mike about how good or bad things are. I've thought a lot about the lying. Like, I get, I think, what they were going for, but something about it doesn't quite land for me still. It would have made more sense to me if Elle had been, like, evasive and simply just not telling people things. Like, that feels more in her character to me, but outright lying, especially when lying in particular, granted, very different context, very different reasoning, et cetera, but lying was such a big part of season three with her on the other side of it. And I get it. It's been a theme since season one, friends don't lie, et cetera, but I don't know. It just felt so like odd making up the fact that she's got so many friends and life is so great. Like I struggle to articulate even what they're going for. Like it kind of makes sense, but I struggle to put it into words and that's kind of the problem.
My least favorite character treatment in all of season four is actually Elle. I don't think any of the decisions made about Elle's character make sense to me. And like, that's fine. Like maybe I don't get it, you know, kind of like what I said about season three, like there's a difference between something being not my jam and being bad, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
Now I have like, you know, like a critical reading of what happens, but overall, I just found pretty much every decision that was made in relation to Elle's character being like, what? Like one of those supercut meme videos of like a confused dog just constantly going,
Yeah.
you know, over and over. Looking at this episode and like in particular and kind of in context overall,
mm-hmm.
I think they didn't know what to do with her. Mm-hmm. And I think they particularly, and we have talked and probably, you know, we'll continue to talk about how some of the decisions made in season three have to then play out in season four.
Yeah.
But honestly, I was not mad about Elle struggling to maintain expending this enormous amount of power over and over and over and her battery draining. Like we talked, you know, mm-hmm, about mm-hmm. like that was interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I don't understand Elle losing her powers. I know at the very end of season three, there was like where she was like trying to get the teddy bear. And there was this implication that maybe she was like still struggling to recover, which is understandable given the amount of power that she had expended so recently. But I don't understand why they chose to then bring that into the season and have it be that she had just lost her powers. You know, especially when you're bringing in Vecna and having it be that they've already faced each other and he has gotten so much stronger in the interim and she doesn't even remember that this happened. There's so much is happening.
They need everybody to be separate so they can come together. That is the Stranger Things formula. That has been the truth. That has been the case of every single season. Yeah. And I think if what they're trying to, and we'll definitely get into more of that with the Russia stuff next episode, but I think Elle losing her powers almost makes more sense if season three had been the end of the show.
Yeah.
So having to come back from that ends up affecting how this whole season ends up being constructed. And it makes for these opening sequences, it just makes things like awkward. I think Elle's plot line in the beginning here, it feels awkward and intentionally, but it's not, doesn't make for a great viewing experience.
I am not a writer on a insanely popular show, but if somebody had come to me and said like, okay, like we need a reason that she's like struggling to recover her powers, I'd say, okay, so she accesses her power through her anger. What if she starts healing? What if she starts actually making friends? What if she goes to therapy? Whatever that looks like in, you know, the Stranger Things world.
We'll definitely be talking about therapy when we get to Max.
Mm-hmm. Like, what if they find, like, a lab-approved or, like, a doctor that she can actually talk to?
Right.
What if things that with her and Mike are just going really well despite the distance? What if she's getting close with Will? What if she's doing well in school? What if all of these lies that she's telling her, instead of just being lies, what if they're actually true and that she can't, she doesn't have that rage anymore?
Like Zuko.
Like Zuko.
I mean,
you know how I feel about Zuko. Yeah, Love of my life.
We all feel about Zuko. Let's be real.
So then she has to find a new path to access her power. That could be so interesting. That could be like, you know, heroine's journey kind of, you know, kind of thing. That could be way cool. But this is like,
I mean, in fact, her being cut off from Mike, I actually really like that idea that they were doing fine.
Mm-hmm.
I think that actually kind of blends into something that I've been thinking about that I would have preferred for Will since our reaction episode. And we'll get to Will in a little bit. But which is just this idea that like Mike was the one who was reaching out and Will had started to pull away because for a myriad of reasons, which I will also definitely touch on a lot more in chapter two, because it comes up a lot more in that. But if Mike was investing, we see that he's back in Hellfire Club. He's more like, not quite, but he's more like the Mike that we knew before season three, not quite completely, but more. They were trying, I think, to course correct with Mike. And so if he was really invested in his relationship with Eleven, I don't know how this would necessarily play out on the back end of the season, which, you know, so we'll see how we feel when we get there. However, but I like that because that adds a different kind of conflict, that if Elle is like really struggling without him there, it doesn't have to be that they're both the whole like I don't mind Mike's arc with not feeling like worthy of her. Again, in concept, I think that's something interesting to play with. We'll touch on that more again once we get to the back end of the season. But the idea that being apart is hard on both of them, they've been apart before. Mm-hmm. There could be a lot of like kind of PTSD that comes up for that. And they're just not interested in exploring that. At least it doesn't seem that that was the direction they chose to go. I mean, Mike was on that walkie-talkie every day when he thought she was dead.
Yeah.
So what? But, you know, if they're trying to make it that she's struggling, she would be struggling in that case. Mm-hmm. And especially because she's removed from Lucas and Dustin and Max. And again, if my idea was that Will forming his own community, if she even kind of didn't really have Will in the same way, and, you know, I like the idea of them being close. Please don't get me wrong. I actually really love that. But if maybe he wasn't as like available to her as it seems like he is, that could have added to that in a really interesting way.
Yeah.
So while we're talking about Elle, let's go ahead and talk about Angela and all of those scenes. I mean, Angela is a caricature. And
yes,
straight out the gate, I can't speak for the the co-hosts that will follow you, but I mean, I know you and I we're not fans, and we don't like any of the way that this is handled. I don't like the way her character is written or directed. She's a caricature. Again, it stands in complete contrast to season one And even to some of the stuff we see with Jason in this season,
yeah,
it's wildly different. So, and the reason I specifically cite the direction as well as the writing is because she sounds like she's reading lines, and the laughter comes across as like super overdone and super unnatural. You know, it's yeah, we're pulling from like an 80s movie or show rather than referencing it, you know, but, and I just, yeah, I don't buy it. And I don't think it's the fault of Elodie Grace Orkin's performance either. I don't entirely, because it does feel like direction to me. And, you know, I'm saying I'm not like fully committing to that, because maybe it is just like, I don't particularly like her interpretation of what she was given to do. I mean, and beyond even just her character, like the tone of these scenes is noticeably imbalanced with the ones that surround it. And I mean, case in point, the transition out of the classroom stuff, which specifically, since you're here, I do want to ask you about some of the like education stuff in this episode. But something I've wondered a lot about when it comes to Angela is if what they might have been, I think I can already hear you telling me that I'm giving them too much credit, but I have wondered if this was intended to be like tipping into unreliable narrator territory, and like this is supposed to be how Elle is experiencing all of this. But if that's, even if that's the case, they don't commit to it enough to make that clear. And they, because again, even in the classroom, like while Elle Evan is giving her presentation, we cut to Will and we see what's going on with Will. Like if this is, if she doesn't fully understand what's happening, if she doesn't understand this behavior, then maybe it would come across this way. And that includes stuff that happens next episode on the rink. But
no, you're giving them way too much credit. Yeah. To fulfill the prophecy. Because we don't do unreliable narrator at any other point in the series.
Well, they've, I feel like, you know, there's stuff in season two where I kind of felt like they were sort of flirting with it, but it's kind of too bad because, you know, in some ways I kind of feel like that would have been a much more interesting direction to go in with her, with what Elle is experiencing. And, but I mean, they don't. And like I said, even if that is what they were going for, they don't commit to it enough. But yeah, it's just, it's not all of her. I don't like any of the scenes with Angela, any of them.
No, I think it's a pretty common experience as a woman to watch things about women written by men and be like, well, you know, you tried, you failed, but you tried. And this is kind of one of those things. It's, and I think again, like the reason it's so unsuccessful is because of how easily you can stack it up against the scenes in season one with Troy, so realistically, so thoughtfully, so subtly. I mean, like, you know, there were scenes in season one with the bullies that weren't necessarily subtle, but the overall treatment of it and like what the reactions from Mike, Will, Dustin, and Lucas were, and like all of that is like, it was, it had a, to use a term that you like, it had a groundedness to it.
Yep.
You do see when girls bully each other, the whole like, oh, like I was just curious, when you're like, you know, you're about to say something nasty and like playing nice in front of the teacher, but then like being mean, coercive, or behind the scenes nasty, mm-hmm. spreading rumors, things like that. Girl bullies are a lot more emotionally abusive. Boy bullies tend to be a lot more physically abusive. And of course, this is a stereotype. Mm-hmm. I'm talking mostly about things that I either experienced or witnessed. Mm-hmm. But Angela is the kind of character that happens when I describe a phenomenon to you, but you've never actually seen it. And then you try to write based off of that. And that's not to say you can, you know, they're only allowed to write things that have happened to them. But I just, they're good enough and talented enough and have enough resources that you can send this to a script doctor. You can get more writers in the room. Like, you have the power to cover your blind spots, mm-hmm. and you're not doing it.
Well, and it would have been so much more effective. Like, I think if they had really made it a lot more authentic, to rather than going for this caricature, I feel like that would have landed a lot harder in a good way. I mean, even in season one, you would not have found a caricature like this.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what I mean when I talk about the tones kind of shifting after season two. You cannot drop Angela into the middle of season one. You can't do it. Yeah, it's not great. I'm interested to know your thoughts, though, on the bit in the courtyard, because we talked a little bit about that off mic when we mm-hmm. watched the episode, when Eleven, they trip her, they break her diorama, and then they taunt her,
yeah.
and then she gets angry, tries to do her powers, and nothing happens.
Work.
Yeah.
The thing that I said off mic and that I stand by is that I don't think that a trauma like losing her powers is something that Elle would forget.
Mm-hmm.
Like, even in a moment of like pure rage, she's not like a loss that enormous. You're not going to forget it. I feel like, you know, losing her powers is absolutely as profound a loss to her as the loss of a family member. So we need to see that Elle is not only physically powerless, but that she is, for the first time in her life, also feeling, for the first time in her life since leaving the lab, she is also feeling emotionally powerless.
Mm-hmm.
That is the place that they have decided to start her at so that, you know, she can go through this arc of change. You can execute that in a really good way, even if that's not what I would personally have chosen. But again, I have a like very confused, like, what reaction to Elle suddenly forgetting that she doesn't have her powers anymore and trying to use them. Like, if she still had her powers and like broke Angela's nose in this scene instead of at the rink and was like, oh shit, I just used my powers in front of all these people.
Yeah, that's where I take an issue with it. Yeah.
That I think would be a little bit more realistic.
Mm-hmm.
Like I can see her getting to a point of like whiteout rage where she forgets that she's not supposed to use her powers in front of people.
She reckless attacks.
she reckless attacks. But I can't see her getting to a place of such rage that she forgets that she no longer has her powers. You know, and then the way that the scene progresses from there is perfectly natural. Like the bullies being like, what the fuck? You know,
I liked her, by the way, that girl, even just when she just says that line, what the hell was that?
Like, yeah,
that is one of the most grounded moments in all of this.
Yeah,
that's
absolutely.
It sounded natural. It sounded organic. I'm like, yeah, more of that energy would have helped.
Yeah. And then like slowly dispersing once the teacher shows up, like all of that was perfectly natural. But again, I just don't understand why.
Her doing that at this moment, you don't need it. If you like, and what I mean by that is if you airlift that part out, the teacher comes out and Elle is still on the ground. She has not gotten up. And the teacher sees it like right after it happened. And so then she says, who did this? And Elle, and maybe helps her off the ground because none of the other kids are helping her.
Yeah.
She says, what happened? And Elle says, the scene proceeds exactly as it does. I just think that would have been more effective. It's just unnecessary. I just don't feel like it really adds enough to validate it being here personally.
I could like, you know, if somebody was saying like, hey, like what was the argument for this scene, do you think? I don't know, like reminding the audience that she no longer has her power, or like establishing for the audience that no matter how angry or in turmoil she gets, she really can't do it anymore.
Which doesn't actually remain to be true.
Yeah.
I would have liked to have seen them explore more of this idea, more intentionally, more directly explore this idea of who am I without the powers?
Mm-hmm.
So that when she gets them back, it's not a, well, now I'm complete again. This feels like that could have fed into that really well, but it doesn't really go much further in that direction. So I just, because we end up having an outburst twice.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing I will say that I like about a lot of this is I like that we're seeing Eleven grieving.
Yeah.
Because we don't get a lot of that. We don't see Joyce grieving. So I appreciated that a little bit more on this rewatch. I don't know that I agree, though, that I don't know. I have mixed feelings about this idea that Eleven would just completely drop her guard right there in front of all those people. That feels a little out of character to me.
Mm, yeah.
If she really thought she had her powers, I feel like she would have done the chin down quick neck
turn.
Something more in that vicinity. But I mean, again, we got to get the whole, they wanted to go super grandiose with it. The like big dramatic music buildup and then nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then in addition to all that, I don't really, I don't really like we talked about it in season three with Steve. I don't like watching characters be humiliated. And this was like, This was another one of those clips that they released ahead of the full release. And I like hated it. Just like on a like watching level, like not even on like a critical level. It was just like, oh, I hate seeing this for her. I don't like this for her.
My kind of thing is like, if she has her power, she doesn't need to do the whole like.
Exactly.
She doesn't need to do the arm out thing. Like, you think she needs that much power to clear a bitch? Like.
Well, she hasn't. We've seen her do so much more with so much, less.
Yeah.
That's the thing. It's like they went for the aesthetic of it, I feel like, more than what felt consistent. I mean, the only time we saw her yell like that has been in occasions when she's been under, I think, a lot, unless I'm forgetting something. I want to put my little asterisk right there. But under a lot more duress, you know, like when she was closing the gate, for example.
Yeah.
I also will say that like when Will comes over to help her, I don't know if he intended it, but the way that Schnapp's voice breaks on okay is just like, it's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
And I also want to add that I think that moment when he comes out of the school and sees all this happening, like, again, I think really simple change. If he had been walking out with other people, some art friends or like other D&D players or theater kids or something else, and then he sees what's happening like that, I just feel like just that one little detail could have added a lot to this moment.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it's not like the scene's ruined because they didn't do that. It's just, that's one of those moments where I'm like, right there, just work that in. And it would have been a really nice little additional detail of like why he wasn't with her in the first place. But I am curious to know kind of your thoughts about this whole setup, specific, not so much like the social stuff, but the Elle being in this class, because it's very clear to me and apparently other Stranger Things fans that she's really out of her depth here. Like, just educationally, socially, why? I mean, this is the 80s. It's not even the 90s when you and I were in school, but I don't know. Just how did all a lot of the like school stuff, the way the teachers treat her, that kind of stuff. Like, do you have thoughts on that? As an educator?
On the one hand, I kind of feel like looking at it too closely doesn't necessarily do anybody any favors, kind of in the way of like a lawyer watching an episode of Law and Order. You know what I mean?
Yeah. That's fair.
But so there's a little bit of that. You know, I've just said, like, I don't really understand why they made a lot of the decisions that they made. But to me, knowing what I know about Elle, it can be nothing but a disservice to her to toss her in among her age group, whatever grade her age group is in, at the local public high school and expect her to perform at a level commensurate with the other kids. It's just not realistic. She has absolutely no social exposure apart from Mike and his friends. She has not experienced the world in the way that the other kids have. I think she needs extra tutelage. I think she needs individual instruction. I think she needs some help. She probably should have been held back at least a grade or two.
And that's kind of why I say, like, I don't know how much of like the 80s of it all might have made an impact.
Yeah, but you know, like they held people back and pushed people forward in the 80s. And then I was, you know, in my, so this is 86. I was in like the first part of my schooling in the very early 90s. And there was some discussion about holding me back a grade because I started kindergarten a year early, but just based on like my birthday, to help me like have another year of getting used to being around kids, because I'm an only child and you know, and pushing me forward a couple grades because my reading skills were testing so high. And what ended up happening was that I didn't repeat a grade or move forward, because the two kind of balanced each other out, and I was kind of like on a level in other subjects. So, you know, all of that is just to say that in the like 86 to 91 range, there was definitely like awareness of like, oh, like this child may have differing social needs. This child may have differing academic needs. but it's going to vary based on how much funding the school has, how much resources the school has, involvement of the parents, so on and so forth. And you asked me a couple questions about what I thought about the teachers' reactions to things. Now, in the classroom, when Angela's doing her thing, I'm not impressed by the teacher because it does not take a 20-year veteran teacher to see when one student is sniping at another student. It's so obvious. And it is your job as a teacher to put a stop to that shit. Now, you're not going to be able to completely because you can't control the student's social lives, but you can control the academic environment. Mm-hmm. That's your job. And in some ways, it's almost like she's like capitulating to it or playing into it.
She seems uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, you are a grown-ass adult, you know. However, in the courtyard, I thought that she handled that very well because she swooped in. She said, who did this to you? And Jane said, nobody. It was an accident, which is, I mean, she's obviously lying. And then she was like, all right, no, that's enough. Angela, let's go.
Elle looks right at them. Mm-hmm. And that's what tips her off. I had missed that in previous viewings.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, so that's how she figures it out. But I don't even think she needed that.
No, I mean, again, like when you are a teacher, you know, you can see what the social dynamics are. It was so easy for me as a teacher, and I was teaching college students who are presumably older and more mature. I'm like, I could see the social dynamics from like the first class. It's not hard.
Yeah.
First of all, because like you're standing up front and they're all in front of you in a big group, you know? So, yeah. But she's also there in service of the plot. So it's fine.
What about the teacher who's like, very disappointing, Jane. Let's talk after break.
Oh, my God. So in 10th grade, I was in a private school. I had been in public school my entire life and all of a sudden ended up in a private school. I had this teacher for French who, like, she and I got along just fine. Languages come fairly naturally to me. And so I got good grades. And so she liked me well enough. But she sniped on students. And by that, I mean just made, like, little remarks to students who struggled, which is a problem for me. It was a problem for me as a student. It's a problem for me now as an educator. I look back on that and I'm like, what are you playing at?
Mm-hmm.
So one of the boys in the class was, I mean, he was just, when I say he was being a teenager or being a teenage boy, I don't mean that in a derogatory, like he was acting disgusting way. I mean, he was having a little bit of trouble sitting still. I don't even remember what it was that provoked her. Like he might have been like, he finished his work and then turned and said something to a friend. It was minor. Like it was a minor thing that happened. Not that she should have let it go, but she turned to him and she was like, well, I'm giving you a 0 on this assignment and your grade can't stand another like low score. I absolutely cannot tolerate authority figures discussing performance in front of everybody as a method of shaming. And that, like, whether that's a teacher talking about a low grade where everybody can hear, or like a supervisor at work being like, well, your evaluation's gonna look shitty. Like, I find that to be completely unacceptable. So 16-year-old Heidi stood up and walked out. The teacher was like, where are you going? And I said, I'm going to the office because I can't be in here. And which I was not the kind of behavior that I showed in school ever. I was a goody two shoes.
Wow.
But I was like, I'm stomping out of here before I say something that's going to get me in detention. And this boy and I were not friends. I mean, we didn't hate each other, but we didn't know each other. But so
it's incredibly on brand for who I know you to be though now, like all these years later.
I just walked right out and I went straight to the office because I was like, if I mouth off, she's going to send me to the office. Let me just go to the office.
Yeah.
So let that just be an indication of my opinion on those kind of tactics. There are some teachers who think wrongly that that treating your students like this will inspire them to work harder.
I guess the implication is that she thinks that Jane is being lazy, but like she's clearly having a hard time. And that's what we're meant to take away from all of this. But
yeah.
I feel like that's a trope I see in a lot of...
Well, it's a common tactic among teachers.
Is it?
Yeah. Okay. as Elle's teacher, I might have done something like wrote, "See me after class," or "Let's talk after break," on the paper itself.
Yeah.
As everybody was shuffling out of the classroom, I might have been like, "Jane, come here for a second," and then handed her a workbook to work on over break.
See, where's Mr. Clark when you need him?
Right, yes.
Well, shifting from one school to another, let's talk about Jonathan and Argyle. Well, first of all, I want to say Argyle is the best part that comes out of this whole group.
Oh my God. I love Argyle. Argyle is my guy.
You said almost, I think you said exactly that in our reactions episode. I think you said, "Argyle's my dude."
Argyle's my dude. I would tolerate the persistent smell of weed. You just know clings around him 24 yeah. hours a day in order to be Argyle's friend.
Yeah. Argyle is fantastic.
Yes.
But the scene that we get between Jonathan and Argyle in Woodshop, that's, we're sort of going to cross over here with Hawkins for a second, because I want to talk about the scene that is Argyle and Jonathan and Fred and Nancy.
Right.
I think I have a unique perspective that is not shared, I don't think, by anyone. So I'm going to be interested to see in how you react to this.
Okay.
And I guess the listeners too. So how does this scene work for you? Like, how do you interpret this scene?
I think this scene functions as a first indication that there may be trouble in paradise for Jonathan and Nancy. I think it plants a seed of doubt that maybe their relationship is not as solid as both of them genuinely want it to be. They both want to be as close as they have always been, but I think they both are starting to feel doubt about what the future actually holds for them, especially as it concerns like college and all of that. Like, she is saying all of these things about how like he feels like he has to be there for his family and blah, 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 blah. And I don't think she's lying, but she is maybe starting to question whether their paths are going to diverge. Given what we find out later about Jonathan, it's very true that he is starting to think that their paths are going to diverge, but he doesn't want to think about it. He's in denial about it. And so he's just being like, "No, of course, everything's fine, blah, blah, blah." Which is why when Argyle says that doesn't pass the sniff test, he's absolutely right.
Okay, so that seems to be the consensus. When I went into the scene, that was what I was expecting the scene to show me.
Mm-hmm.
Problem for me with that is that for me, the framing, the music, the editing, and even the performances all seem to back up what they say.
Right.
Their later behavior and statements and the fact that their relationship will appear to be on the rocks seems contradictory to this scene. Like, and maybe it was, they didn't want it to be heavy-handed. I don't know. But it's like, in terms of the framing, they are facing each other.
Right.
They are finishing each other's sentences. They're not contradicting each other. Like, everything they say, and that's why I say the performance isn't including in that, because to me, they both seem to be very solid in what they're saying. It doesn't seem to be, I don't pick up on any falseness in what they're saying, or like, and yet it doesn't seem like they're coming on too strong. But I also, I mean, I hear what Fred and Argyle are saying, but it's like, again, the music, the editing, et cetera, et cetera. It all seems to be, I mean, I'm repeating myself at this point, but backing them up as right. opposed to like, again, if they had been facing opposite directions, like if they had been on like opposite sides of the table and the framing had them facing away from one another, that would have indicated it to me. So I guess part of the reason that I wonder if they're not meant to be demonstrating, like if that might have been the intention, was like, no, they're still in sync with each other.
Right.
Is because they want it to be more of a triangle.
I don't think it's meant to indicate that they're on the rocks or that they are headed for doom, because I like the only theory that I have about the love triangle is there is no end game that's already set. They have not made a decision about which couple is going to be end game.
I like that. I'm gonna agree with you on that. I'm gonna co-sign that. I mean, they might have now, but
yeah, I mean, as in like in development of season 5. But so I think they want there to be room for you to watch this scene retroactively and be like, and have it feel authentic. Yeah, of course, it indicates like Nancy and Jonathan, five ever. you know, or right, whatever right, the right. kids are saying now.
Right, right.
Or you could go back to this scene and have it feel like, yeah, you know, here's the indication. They're just like, they want to still be on the same page, but they're growing apart.
Mm.
And just because you get to a point in a relationship where you are separated by distance, physical distance, if not emotional distance, there you can reach a point where you're like, oh, like, I hope we're not falling out of sync and like mm-hmm. feel worried about it. But that doesn't mean that ultimately mean that you are falling out of sync.
Mm.
And it much in the way that like when we see them reunited later, they do have a really genuine moment together.
They do.
When they're first together again.
And even when they're working on the window.
Yeah. Like, yeah. You know,
they do seem to still have a connection.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. So
I'm not like wildly off here.
No,
because like hearing everybody say what you said, I'm like, I guess I like really missed it on this. I don't know.
This is not the conversation with Jonathan, Nancy, and Murray, where Murray's like, and we like Steve. This right, is not right. that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a good point. I mean, and I do like, I like it as a reading because then in the next episode when Jonathan tells Argyle that like, no, actually there is trouble in paradise, that Argyle is surprised.
Yeah.
As if indicating that he bought it all.
Yeah.
I mean, Fred continues to like, you know, pester Nancy, like, you know, until his untimely death, unfortunately. But
yeah, alas, poor Fred, we hardly knew you.
Well, the thing I will say too is that one of the reasons I think this scene works, because I will say that, like, I enjoy watching this scene. Mm-hmm. It's got a really nice rapid fire pace to it. It's engaging. I like the camera angles. I like the music. It's a nice edit as well. And the I think what's interesting is that Fred and Nancy, and then Jonathan and Argyle, both of those two pairs of people have really interesting chemistry with one another.
Yeah.
I think really adds to like why this scene kind of crackles in the way that it does. So, but I just found myself watching it, preparing for this, like, why is my read so different from everyone else's?
Your read is just like one facet to the left on the same diamond. Right. Don't worry about it.
All right. And then as far as Joyce is concerned, she gets the package. She's working from home.
Yeah.
And there actually was an interesting detail I noticed when she greets the mailman. She asks about the college letters,
uh-huh.
which made me kind of wonder, so has Jonathan been lying to her too?
Oh, absolutely.
But I just hadn't really thought about it
yeah.
until, again, prepping for this. I was like, that makes me sad. Because again, like kind of like Will and Joyce, I really love Jonathan's relationship with Joyce.
Yeah.
And we haven't really seen them interact
no.
in like a while.
Well, Jonathan has retreated into smoking weed all the time.
Right.
And Joyce is distracted. So
yeah.
My kind of 2023 take on Jonathan is that I still don't get it. Like, it's fine, I guess. And that's kind of where I've landed with a good portion of this episode. It's fine, I guess, but I don't get it.
Right. Well, we haven't gotten to the good stuff yet.
Yeah,
we
haven't. True,
yeah,
true.
We're unfortunately this episode is front loaded with a lot of the stuff that we don't care for. The good stuff's coming. I promise. There is stuff about this episode we both love, and we're about to get to it actually, because I think we're ready to talk about Hawkins.
Yay!
So we're actually going to pause right here and continue our discussion of Chapter 1, The Hellfire Club, into another episode and devote all of that, a part 2, to just the Hawkins section of the episode. So stay tuned for that. Links to find us on social media are in the show notes, along with a couple of other links to things that we referenced, including Elephant and the Ham Radio podcast, where you can find Jasmine and Ashley, and they will actually be joining me in a future episode. As always, thank you for listening, and until next time, over and out.
Yeah.
I just realized I'm just like, we're just starting. It's been a year since we've done this, so
now I have church giggles.
Right.
And you have a noisy neighbor.
Mm-hmm.